Welcome to the Tension Podcast Series. I'm your host, Donna DuPont with the Archipelago of Design. Today's podcast is going to focus on the world of serious games. Joining me today is Dr. Philippe Beaulieu-Brossard, professor at the Canadian Forces College, designer, and co-founder of the Archipelago of Design. Welcome. As well as joining me is Scott DeYoung, PhD researcher at Concordia University in Montreal, game designer, educator, and public scholar. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
So to start us off, for our audience who may not be familiar with your work and with serious games, so tell us a bit more about your pathway to serious games and what attracted you to the world of gaming.
For sure. I mean, the journey for everyone is unique, and it's actually really fun to hear for everyone. For myself, I can say that I've always been a game designer when I look back being a kid writing up silly house rules for games or things like that. But more formally, I think it started when I became an educator during and through my undergrad, which I did in primary education. So I was working in kindergarten classrooms up to grade six, and I was trying to bring games into the curriculum and the work that I was doing. From there, more formally, I moved into doing a master's in media studies, where I decided to look at escape rooms as a genre where you could talk about really intense, serious digital issues. So I made a game that talked about echo chambers and filter bubbles online, using an escape room to model that, which was a lot of fun. And then now, today, I'm in my PhD, and I'm continuing that work looking at board games, tabletop role-playing games, narrative adventure games, and I think today we'll talk a bit about the board game that I made, or the simulations design game I made called Losers and Lies, which is about conspiracy theory online. And so it's been a trajectory of kind of connecting research and passion with game design and systems thinking.
Thank you, Scott. Yeah, I think that you hit the something here with research and passion. So for me, it started with passion because I've been playing video games and board games with my family since I'm probably five, but I never really considered them as a potential medium for research, transferring knowledge, and also bring potential transformation to the players, because I was trained as an academic not to take games seriously and to also be a gamer in the closet. It's not well seen in the academic world to say that you are a gamer, because you're seen as wasting time that you could put in your next masterpiece book, so to speak. And I reached a point in my career and life where the tension was unbearable to live. And this is when I was in Copenhagen as a Marie Curie researcher at the University of Copenhagen. And during the pandemic, I was playing games as I used to, and I played The Last of Us 2. And I found it such a transformative moment for me. It made me realize a lot of things about myself. The games make you really violent. I discovered there are dark places in me that are or can be violent under certain circumstances. And it was extremely powerful in putting me into the perspective of somebody that the game made me totally hate, and make me play the game from that perspective. And there is no other mediums that could have made me go through this transformative moment. And at this point, it was like tension break, and I went to the Archipelago of Design network to say that if we want to practice what we preach, if we believe in providing transformative learning experiences, we need to develop a game. And then the rest is history, but that led to Breakthrough, which is our first game.
Wow. Well, that's an incredible, both of you, incredible pathway to developing games and using games. As you were saying, Philippe, that there's some misconceptions around use of games. And so in terms of the games for transformation, for learning, are these considered like a different style of games? We use the term serious games a lot. What does that mean in the context of the type of work that you do?
Yeah, I think that there is a serious game is a bit of a misnomer. And just in the name express a malaise, right? It basically says to people that, well, we should take games seriously because they are not being taken seriously enough, and you can use it to achieve a specific goal. In our respect, it's more to change perspective and mindsets about a specific topic, right? So I think that there's a lot of misconception there, and also it creates a bit of a bit of a tension where a lot of game designers, they want to make sure that the seriousness of it is preserved throughout. So it may end up in games that are not really fun, and you lose the game aspect of the game. So in general, I would say a serious game is a game that tries to achieve something beyond just play for the sake of play, which is also good in itself. And that also can compare to other mediums like the simulations or the war game. But I would say the serious game is perhaps a bit more flexible as a genre to develop, and maybe more aligned with the, you know, sort of tabletop board games and video games that we play casually.
Yeah, and I think you raised some really interesting, like, talking about those lines and boundaries. But one of the things that I also talk about is that, like, as a term, as you mentioned, serious games is kind of fluffy in the sense of it doesn't really boil down into anything specific. When I incorporate it into my dialogue, I refer to games that are serious or games that are trying to achieve a particular goal, which I separate from educational games, which are typically trying to engage with a particular curriculum objective. And so serious games can range from awareness raising approaches to just sitting in something that might be considered more dark or not necessarily fun. For my own uses, I think that any game can be seen or framed as serious. We can take popular games and we can facilitate them in ways that make them serious and engaging. However, from a design standpoint, I think what makes a game serious is the content that you're trying to engage with in what you're doing, what you're wanting your players to experience, and what you're hoping your players get out of the experience of playing in the game. And so for me, that's kind of where I sit on my lines, but I recognize that different games can be taken up in different ways.
And the other point I would like to add to this is that if you look at the more commercial industry of you know, video game and board game design, it doesn't mean that even if perhaps the key purpose is to develop a fun experience, enjoyable experience, it doesn't mean that there are no serious goals behind them. Like if you look at The Last of Us 2 that I shared, of course, the designers had a transformative goal in mind, but that's not something that they put to the foreground, right? That's something that as designers, they really most likely believed in. Not something that they believe would necessarily sell copies, but that's something that was there. And I think you can find some parallels with the film industry, where a lot of movies may seem super entertaining, but there are a lot of subversive aspect to the movies that may make yourself reconsider, you know, something entirely about society by watching this movie. And just real quick, if for everybody who watched Top Gun Maverick, right, the old relationship between the protagonist and the barmaid that he's going to of course charm and all that is totally reversed if you compare it to the first movie. Like it really forces you to challenge the way you look at relationship between men and women and all that, although it's not a movie about that at all. It's a movie about fighter pilots killing bad guys, right? So I think there's still a way that it's a bit of a false dichotomy between serious games and games for entertainment. It's just the way they message their purpose that is, okay, I would say, different.
Yeah. So different intent, different purpose. And of course, different design intentions in the creation of it as well, which is, I think, really important. So if somebody wanted to explore games, like a more of a serious game that has a purpose, like why should they use a game as opposed to a more traditional form of learning or exploring a topic? What does games have to offer that's unique?
I mean, my first answer is what can't games offer is more a way to think about that question. But if we look at any media, whether it's games or movies, as Philippe just mentioned, they all offer very unique ways to engage with content matter. What games do really well is they invite interaction. I'm someone who, I told you before, I'm a game designer, and that's the bio we used for this, but I sometimes refer to myself as a play designer, because what I'm looking at is how do people interact with systems, and how do interacting with those systems, whether it's as simple as playing cards in a game of Uno, or as complex as playing a game of Twilight Imperium, for anyone who's familiar with that six-hour endeavor. How are you choosing to interact with that system? What agency do you have in that system? And in doing so, what do you learn in that process? And so games allow us a chance to engage with particular subject matter, particular storylines, particular content in ways that are relatively safer than engaging with them in person, or relatively distant than engaging with them in person. So it gives us a chance to explore what potential possibilities could come out, our own emotions, or the emotions of others around us as we engage in particular things. And one of the things that I talk about by making board games about digital issues is that it can make it tangible. It makes it physical, it makes it felt. And in doing so, it can ground that learning inside a person or a player so much more.
Yeah, I think that you you hit the mark with the keyword agency. I think this is really what differentiates this medium to others like a PowerPoint presentation or a movie and all that. And it can really make the player reflect about their choices, right? Choice matter and may lead to unintended consequences and all that. And the other point, as Scott put it, is the safe space, right? To experiment, to fail, and learn from the failure as you go. Because especially in the security sector, there's no tolerance to failure at all. But in a game, like, you can experiment, you can fail and learn from that those failures. So hopefully you fail less in real life. Also for me, it's the ultimate art form of the 21st century because it brings together all of the other mediums. Like we were talking about movies, well, you use the same movie techniques, you use the same sound effects, and you know, even original music, artworks and all that. So it's basically all the best of all of the other mediums put into a single medium that is, I believe, also way more immersive and all that, that you can, you know, escape in those worlds. And I think that this is key to make an experience that's going to stick with the player, that they might remember for years after, if you compare it to other experience like a lecture. Yeah.
I just want to reiterate to our players that Philippe made a really strong point around failure. I think it's not talked enough about in both design conversations, but also by players and educators, that some of the most powerful learning moments in our lives, especially when we're talking about serious games, are when we fail. I mean, I'm sure many of us can think about moments in our day-to-day life where we go home and we lay on the pillow of our bed existentially thinking about how we messed up a conversation or should have done X thing better in the day. And we reflect on those moments and we grow from those moments. And games are a really powerful space to allow us to fail, as Philippe was saying. And it's really important to remember that allowing players to fail is where a lot of the learning and engagement can really come through.
So it sounds like both of your games provide an entryway to explore complexity in a very safe, but a more enjoyable way. What do you think about that? Was that part of the initial intention behind your design?
I mean, I like that you use the word enjoyable, because sometimes people, when they look at complex systems, are like, I want to smack my head against a wall. But I like to think that playing the game can be enjoyable. It's definitely a point of consideration. I mean, I come out of the education space, as I mentioned before, and I work in the communication studies area. And when we're looking at educational games, I'm sure all of us are familiar with those math games that are just worksheets back on a computer, or they're very simple processes where you get like a point or a star for answering a question correctly and we move on, right? Those edutainment or gamified learning experiences. And while those have merit and have some value in certain places, when we're talking about complex issues, right? So the game that I made, Lizards and Lies, talks about disinformation. That's not something that has a singular answer. It's not something that has a binary response. And because of that, it's how do we design models that can not just simplify it, because you don't want to get rid of levels of complexity, but make it at players' level so that they're only engaging with a chunk at it. And so Lizards and Lies, when you sit down, there's text, there's cards, there's tokens, but you're only focusing on your own objectives. You're only focusing on your own cards. And while what the other players are doing is different than you, and that adds a level of complexity, it also allows you to focus on what aspect of the system, what slice of this disinformation pie am I trying to address? And in that, the joy hopefully comes out through trying to address that goal most effectively, or to the way that you think it should be seen as a player. And in that process, I also look to encourage players to reflect and learn, once again, kind of bringing it back to that.
Yeah, and I think in a similar way, if you look at Breakthrough, I mean, it was one of the key objectives is to make the player more comfortable with this idea of complexity and the unknown and all that, especially for an audience of security professionals, because security professionals are trained to try to simplify, you know, the reality to be able to advise or make decision. Like at some point you have no choice. And for us, it's more to bring back to say, yes, you need to be more comfortable with complexity and navigate it. And then you're going to be in a better position to make it a decision. So, and actually the game is actually a complexity simulator, if you will, because it put the players into the role of an investigator who tries to unravel a mystery. And actually the mystery in the end, no spoiler alert, but it's a complex system that is at work with so many stakeholders that are all interrelated and all that. And at the end of the game, as a result, the player is more comfortable with the messiness, if you will, of a complex system, and come to awareness that their perspective is just one perspective among many on what happened in this complex system. So I think it's a fantastic way to learn systems that we live by by experiencing them instead of just trying to learn about them in books.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you mentioned like messy, right? And complex systems, a lot of the issues that we're worried about and talking about, the reason there's polarized and they're ideologically divided and people have so many opinions on them is because they're messy, depending on whose perspective you're talking to or what background information you're coming to it with or what articles you're even reading to learn about it when we talk about news stories. It's a messy space of stakeholders and ideas and politics and culture. And so what games can do well, these complex games, yes, these games are complex, but they're trying to make sense of that mess. They're trying to pull pieces. No game is perfect. No game is ever going to get every single avenue and direction there, but they're at least going to pull some of those pieces out of that mud and make them clear for the player so then we can talk about them. We can engage in them. We can talk about the different angles that sit there and why people are acting a certain way or why certain decisions are being made. And so I think viewing games as kind of making sense of the mess is a really nice way to put it.
Yeah, definitely complex systems are very messy and in itself has a lot of tensions to navigate. So when you're facilitating your game, what types of tensions do you notice like that players experience as they're exploring this complex system?
The nicest, I think, comment we received on Breakthrough is that we found a way to teach in a non-judgmental way biases. And actually, you can see from an external perspective all of our cognitive biases at work as the players try to unravel the mystery because they rely on very, very limited information. So a tension that we see, one of them is when they start the investigation is the instinct to follow a rabbit hole, to really get as much information as possible on just one single, let's say, actor, we'll say Russia, for instance. And then the players may really lose the big picture that they need to really proceed with the game. So we really see this tension between, the preserving an holistic perspective of reality and drilling down to a more reductionist perspective to really know well the parts before making a decision. And you can really see the professional biases of players. Those who are really analysts, especially intelligence analysts, are being rewarded to really go into the details. So they may fall more into that trap. The other one that we see a lot is the tension between problem and solution. Most players will already know from the first phase of the game that, oh, this is probably the mystery and here is the solution, while the game kind of forced them to stick in a space for them to understand more fully the problem before going to solution. So these are, I would say, two main core tensions that you can see in the game and that, of course, we play with, not to torture the player, but for them to make them learn about those.
Yeah, and to think about tensions, I like to break it into design tensions versus player tensions. And so in making a game about disinformation, I was very cognizant that there was going to be, as Philippe kind of just mentioned in their own work, of like pre-consisted expectations and biases coming into the game. And so especially for something as politically charged as fake news, conspiracy theory, which is what the game's getting at, it was like, well, how can we design already around the fact that these tensions will be at the table to avoid them? And so certain things are in the game where the conspiracy theories that you're spreading are meant to be silly and not overly believed in by the average player, so that you're not creating political tensions at the table. You're also, we decentered content from the game. So while content exists in the game through tokens, it's not like you're looking at particular news articles or posts that you're making your own opinions, and you have your own opinions on the stories being told. There is a narrative in the game, but it's overarching, that's meant to frame the actions you're taking. And so that's how you can think about tensions in design. But when to your question of like players in the game itself, there are still tensions in the space. So the game has you either spreading conspiracy theory or removing it. And you have players who will talk about how they feel about, you know, manipulating audiences or trying to engage with false news in certain groups, and like the mwahaha maniacal villains that they become, or the like, well, I kind of don't want to win. Like, I want the good guys to win, but I'm going to win if I do this. And so they have these kind of moral tensions that come up in the gameplay. But I love that that happens. Like, I love when players look at your system and they're like, I don't know if I agree with this, or like, I'm struggle to face something about myself in this. Because when that happens, and this is why I'm a big proponent of like reflexive and reflective design, it encourages them to think about like, why? Like, why are you struggling right now? Or why are you engaging in this tension? And so you can't stop players from having their opinions and beliefs. And in fact, you should encourage them. It's just, how do you design it so that when they come out, they're not framed in ways that are combative, but in ways that are progressive or allow for kind of reflexivity?
Yeah, very good. That's so interesting. I love the fact that, you know, that both of your games really, it allows the player to really, they have to dive deep into the tension. And there's, when you think about design, the tension is so important, because those were where the opportunities are for new ideas, new thinking. And when you go to the reflective part of your activity, you get to learn a bit about that. When you do your debriefs or your reflective activity, what are some of those key lessons that come out? Are there any themes that you've noticed in those that engage with your games?
Well, surprisingly, or perhaps less surprisingly, the first theme is to bring to awareness the way the group organize itself and think as a group. And surprisingly, most groups who start playing the game don't take the time to properly say, okay, how do we want to run this? Like, who does what, and what are who is good in what, and stuff like that. Usually the players just try to dive into the game and go as fast as possible, but by not taking this moment, and it became sort of a key lesson learned for many people who play the game. Like, every time we do teamwork on a complex problem, we should just sit down and just think about how do we want to organize ourselves, and instead of just diving right into the world. So that may be easy, but that's one that we didn't see before we were playing the game, that came up as well. How do you organize and manage the information with your team? Like, and how the way you manage information will make a lot of difference in the perspective and outcomes that you're going to get. So that's a core part of the debrief that we have. The other one, as I talked before, is about the biases in sense making and the way the player try to understand what is going on in the situation. And the very last one is the relationship between problem and solutions. The fact that once we decided what the problem is, it really put blinders on our eyes about the solutions. And it's good to actually do a lot of ping pong between the way we see the problem and the way we see the solutions. That once we think we know what the problem is, we should not jump to conclusion and not go back. Like, we should, as we work on a project, we should always go back and forth. Otherwise, we may put us, as we see, our ladder on the wrong wall in the end. So, and just this, for me, to have developed a game that has all of those lessons learned is extremely powerful, especially for people who have not been exposed to those fundamentals before. So that was really the key to introduce these fundamentals in a way that you experience them, and that then after that, as a player, you have a ha-ha moment. And then when you go back to work, hopefully some of that stick when you face some complex problems.
Yeah, I love a good aha moment in the game when you see a player kind of connect with the material and then they're like really into it, or they're really about to talk about how their own life experiences tie in. You know that you've been effective in kind of reaching them in that space. And so for me, I mean, I've had debriefs with, you know, 16-year-olds up to like 70, 80-year-olds about kind of disinformation in their lives and how it comes up. And those are always really meaningful moments. But the aha moment always happens when you sit down, and I mentioned before, they have their slice of the pie. And so when they sit down and they start talking about their slice of the pie, how they were able to succeed or fail in the system that they were playing in, and then someone else was like, well, that's because I did this, or that's because I couldn't do this. And all of a sudden they start to connect how these issues, the layers that are there. And so one of the key things for me is I love seeing players peel back the layers of, it wasn't just because someone posted a meme on Reddit that this content spread, but it was a coordinated campaign where these communities were primed to gain disinformation. There were actors pushing it for other agendas or goals. And seeing players connect how their actions had a ripple effect in a system to someone else's actions is where I've really found those reflective pieces to be most successful and powerful. The one that I still sit on beyond that is also players talk a lot at the end of the game about how they would implement this. Because I will be honest, the game takes about 2 hours to play. And that's not feasible for classroom teachers to use. It might be feasible for a university lecturer to use, but you don't always got 2 hours in your day to run a game with your students. And so there's a lot of questions, and we're talking about tensions, about how do we make effective tools that can either fit within or even challenge the spaces where they're supposed to run. If you're able to, you know, run workshops with people, it's okay, because you can be like, you know, book off the afternoon and come play this game. But if you're trying to partner with these communities that need these resources, it becomes, how do we then shift or alter these tools to fit with them? And that's like a separate tension that comes up with players being like, I really enjoyed this, but now I want to use it and I want to figure out how. And then we have great conversations about that.
So before we wrap up this podcast, I just want to know, do you have any final thoughts? Or is there anything that we haven't touched on that you think is really important for our audience to know around games?
Well, when I talk about serious games and when we talk about tension, which was, you know, the name of the podcast, there's so many things that I could sit on and talk about, but I think it's important to recognize, and I think we have somewhat emphasized it in our conversation, but serious games are really cool. They're really effective, well, they can be, but they're really underutilized, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And I mentioned earlier, you know, the challenges of implementing them into classrooms, but also, just as Philippe mentioned, the biases that come with the idea that we're going to play a game about X subject matter. And I think it's just really important to be aware of that this is a really impactful space, but there's a lot of roadblocks we have to get through. Alone, trying to get funding from different bodies to try to make these games possible is a real challenge, because when they read on their grant application that you're making a game as opposed to a policy report, they might not always buy in. However, I will say a game can lead to a policy report, and some of those policy reports are incredible. So for any listener, remember that.
And vice versa, you can use a game to familiarize people with the insights of a policy report. So it's not isolated for sure. What was very stimulating about Breakthrough is that we started from not knowing an answer to the challenge of developing a game to learn about systems thinking and design thinking. There was nothing that was very satisfying out there. And when we came up to the table, it was very... It set the conditions for people to be extremely creative and just try things that didn't work. It doesn't matter. But this understanding that everything that was created became a stepping stone to reach this this game that we had in mind. And we are facing the same sort of process with a new game we want to develop to contribute to cultural evolution, transformation in the national security team in Canada, but also across NATO members and partners. And it's... Not that it's impossible, but for instance, if we talk about issues like sexual harassment, like inclusivity and all that, I'm frightened. I don't have an answer of how we can create a game that may contribute to this, but I have hope that we're going to get there. And it's super sensitive. But at the same time, that's what makes it so stimulating, because it's both a very important cause, but it's also extremely stimulating intellectually about how might we get there. So I would say in the end, it's just don't be afraid to go into the impossible, because that's the impossible that, you know, create the motivation and to break this this impossible, this feeling.
Yeah, I mean, you put the nail on the head in terms of, like, games allow for some really cool creative moments, and I think it's important not to shy away from allowing that to occur. I mean, the creativity, the expression, the agency that can come through playing alone is so potent, and finding ways to allow us to express that and engage in that is really powerful. And so I just want to echo what you're saying, but in terms of, like, next steps as well, there's always new directions that we can take things in. And I mentioned before, like, games aren't always the answer, but they're also an answer that isn't always explored. And so when you're thinking about, like, we're back at this issue for, like, the X number of times, well, have you tried looking at games as a method to solve it? What resources and mediums have you looked at? Maybe games are underused in that space. And why? Is it because no one's been thinking about them or interested in it? Or is it because it actually didn't work? And typically, it's the former, not the latter, answer in that response. And so for me, Losing Lives was a prototype. It was asking, how can we look at disinformation, not from a, like, how do we fact check it, but from how does it work perspective. And the game does that, but it also creates its own tensions where it's trying to both teach you and show you a system. And that can be really hard in classrooms. I mentioned before, it's like 2 hours long and teachers don't like that. So when we're talking about future steps and next directions, I'm breaking it into two other games now. I mean, Lizards and Lies will stay as Lizards and Lies, and I'm always happy to run and talk about that game because it does its job well. But I'm moving into making kind of tools and resources and games that are targeted at, you know, school children, so they can understand why disinformation comes up on their newsfeed, not from a how do I deal with it, but how does this actually lead to what I'm seeing, as well as working with stakeholders to make games that fit into the challenges and concerns they have around the systems that are behind it, because there's so many layers to that onion that I'm trying to unpeel. So,
well, I want to thank you both for a fantastic conversation on serious games. I've certainly learned a lot. If our audience wants to get in touch with you, learn more about your game, how can they do that?
I mean, I got all the socials, which I think, so I got X, formerly known as Twitter. I have LinkedIn. You can email me at scottbdeyoung@gmail.com, or you can just Google Lizards and Lies and you'll see the website for it come up. But I'm always happy to either consult or talk about this stuff or engage in it or just give you feedback on what you're doing. There's not a lot of us out here making serious games. We're growing, and I'm happy every time I meet someone. So if you're interested in working in this space, I'm happy to work alongside you.
Yeah, so likewise, the way we work at AOD for Games is that we developed a project community or community of interest on the game. And we have this principle of up on, up off, because everybody is busy. So sometimes if you want to join, you can join midway in the project, contribute as a playtester or in contributing with content and all that. Up off later, and that's totally fine. So, and for that, you can just join us at info@aodnetwork.ca, and we'll link you up with the project lead. But for Breakthrough in itself, we have a fantastic brochure you can find on the website aodnetwork.ca, and also you can reach us out to organize a demo of the game, or even a full session for you and your team. It's a pleasure. Right now, a lot of organizations are using it. RCMP, Bank of Canada, Canadian School of Public Service, and it's growing. So that's fantastic. So please be one of them.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. And we'll definitely put some information perhaps on the website next to this podcast that helps our audience find your contact information.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.